Today we feature two novelists who couldn't be more different in style and structure, but both write about parents and families who suffer through trauma and transition. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. I recently had the pleasure of talking with Silas Dent Zobel, author of the acclaimed novel The People of the Broken Neck, a story about family, about violence and post-traumatic stress, and a reflection on the legacy of each person's life. I spoke to him from Provence, where he is on sabbatical, and we'll listen to that conversation in a bit. Gail Forman is a literary star in the young adult genre and has recently released a novel, as she says, starring adults and geared toward that audience. Leave Me is the story of a wife and mother who leaves home to find herself. So please stay with us. It's A Novel Idea. Gail Forman is a journalist and award-winning author who has gained a tremendous following for her young adult novels, which include I Was Here, Just One Day, and If I Stay, which was made into a major motion picture. Her YA fiction is known for her compelling characters and hard-hitting narratives, and Leave Me, geared toward an adult audience, approaches subjects some only fantasize about, like leaving your job, your husband, and children, to find some peace and engage with your own identity. That's just what Mary Beth does, the protagonist of this book. Gail Forman, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
We're here to talk about your latest published novel, Leave Me, and we are going to talk about it. But I think some of our listeners and readers, I want to give them a little background in case they're unfamiliar with your work.
Sure.
You started out as a journalist with publications in magazines, but your first book that I'm aware of is a nonfiction book, a travelogue, You Can't Get There From Here, A Year on the Fringes of a Shrinking World.
We're really going back in time.
Well, we are going back in time, but, you know, when I looked at that book and I look at your current writing, I can't help but to feel that that has, well, certainly informed the rest of your life and that must seep into your writing. Let's just fill our listeners and readers in on that particular book and what it
Sure.
brought to you, what it meant for you.
Sure. My husband and I traveled around the world in 2002, and I wrote a book about it, and it was partially a reported book, sort of drawing on my interest as a journalist. And I noticed as we traveled that there was a kind of cultural globalization, and this was 2001, 2002. Globalization was a big buzzword, and you heard about it in sort of monetary terms or in these trade deals, which are now back in the news. But what I noticed is there was this sort of cultural globalization where these communities, particularly those kind of on the fringe of places that were already far away, were being affected by cultural aspects from other places coming in, whether it was in Tonga, a community known as the Fakaleti, or whether it was these Tolkienists in Kazakhstan who had gotten a hold of the Tolkien books and would act them out in the mountains, and they were actually forced into the mountains because the government there viewed them as an unauthorized religion. They were still coming at it with a very Soviet mindset. So I wrote about that. And then the kind of through line through that, it was also a more personal story about my husband and me and what traveling for a year straight did to our marriage and the stresses and strains. So it was kind of this hybrid of a kind of a travel memoir and a reported travel book.
And that was in immediately after 9/11.
Yes.
And so certainly that maybe touched you at the beginning. But since that time that you did all that traveling, the world has changed quite a bit.
It does change, but it's one of the things that I continue to tell myself is – So we had been planning and saving for this trip for about 2 years. And originally the plan was that we were going to be gone for New Year's Eve, going from 2001 to 2002. And then 9/11 happened, and we wondered if we should go at all. The world suddenly seemed very, very dangerous. And we decided to just go anyway. And what we found was that the world, it's so much more dangerous on a TV screen than it is in reality. And then we got places where you wouldn't necessarily think Americans would be embraced. And particularly because we were from New York City, people, when they heard that, there was just so much sympathy and sadness. And that was something that I kind of carry with me, because I think right now the world seems scarier yet. And there definitely are some things that are very disturbing happening. But you realize that it's a distortion based on what you see on the news. And actually, you go out there into the world and things are not nearly as bad. And people are, they want the same things that we all want. They want their families to be okay. They want their children to thrive. So I think I carry that lesson with me, even on days when sometimes it's harder to convince myself of that.
That it's that eyeball to eyeball, person to person interaction that really is the foundation of who we are.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. In the preface to that book, you, and granted, this was written 15 or so years ago or thereabouts, you mention your growing up and maybe your teen years of maybe being
a weird girl.
Okay. I was groping for a word, a weird girl. Yeah. And then you have gone on to write young adult fiction and have quite a following in that genre. How much did your own growing up years and young adulthood directly lead you into writing for that audience?
It's a good question. You know, the kind of weird girl just meant that, and now I think it's interesting because there's become like this nerd culture that's been embraced, and I think that's just wonderful. And particularly in the YA world, this whole nerdcore community that kind of rejoices in that, and there's so much more acceptance. But when I was growing up, there was less room for that kind of thing. So you kind of found your niche. And with me, it really was traveling early on. I went to England when I was 16 as an exchange student and just happened to wind up at this school full of wonderful weirdos. And it was discovering through traveling that this was my place. And I think that led me to then take a few years off before starting college, which again made the travel and the desire to put myself outside my comfort zone and willingness to do that go on through my life. Interestingly, though, when I started writing YA, and I was always drawn to young people, writing about young people and for young people even as a journalist. But when I started writing young adult novels, I discovered that I actually wasn't going back to my teen years to kind of relive them. Because honestly, by the time I was like 15, I'd kind of figured it out. The weird girl stuff was a little more painful when I was younger. And what I really wanted to do was to work out what was going on with adult me, you know, whether I'm dealing with a loss or whether I'm dealing with something else. It's something that adult Gail in my life wants to work out through these books. But just for whatever reason, at least until Leave Me, it's always been characters between the ages of, say, 17 and 25 to tell the story for me. So I think that the kind of feeling like an outsider definitely is a hallmark you hear of a lot of novelists or young adult novelists. And it pushed me to travel, which I think changed the way I look at the world. But then once I started writing, I wasn't writing about being 16 or 14 or 12 and feeling, you know, ostracized. Although I do write about that, but I've come to think that everybody feels like they don't fit in. It's just some people are better at kind of masking it.
So you weren't pushed in that direction based on what you'd already written. It was a choice that this is an audience or this is a voice I want to be reaching out to. Or how did that evolve?
My first novel I wrote by accident. It's called Sisters in Sanity, and it was right after my daughter was born, and You Can't Get That From Here just recently come out, and my journalism work had really kind of slowed down because I wasn't able or willing to travel in the way I had before. And I remember kind of being in a panic and being like, what should I do? I can't make the rent. And somebody said to me, you should write a young adult novel. And it seemed like such an absurd idea until I thought about it for about 2 seconds, and then I sat down and started writing Sisters in Sanity, which was based on an article I'd written years before at one of my first magazine jobs at 17. And when I wrote that, it was this surprise because I somehow, and I think through writing You Can't Get There From Here, which has 8 different narratives, I had learned to write a novel, but also that I really loved this. When I wrote If I Stay a few years later, I was worried that I was actually writing myself out of the young adult world. The editor I'd been working with and the agent I'd been working with had both ceased to do that kind of work. And so I was starting from scratch, and I started writing this book, and it didn't seem like a young adult novel that I had read. It was sort of dark, and it was nonlinear, and it, you know, this takes place from a girl who's in a coma, sort of seeing everything that's going on. And I just felt so compelled to write it, I decided not to worry about any of that. And when I saved the original draft onto my computer, the file name was Why Not, as in, I don't think this is going to go anywhere, but why not? When I finished it and it started to go out into the world, then we let people decide if this was young adult or not. And interestingly, in certain countries, it was published as an adult novel, in certain countries, young adult. So I definitely was not pushed into it. It was more when I wrote Sisters in Sanity, I looked back and realized that my whole career, because when I was in journalism school, I really wanted to work for this wonderful teen magazine called Sassy. That was my goal. That there was a reason I'd been drawn to that, and there was a reason that this voice fit very naturally to me. And so I embraced it full on. And then as I got more into it, I just, you know, I feel like we're in a golden age of young adult literature right now, in part because for years we were like the kids at the kids' table at Thanksgiving. Nobody was paying attention to us, and so we could break all the rules. And so I think you had some really wonderful experimental, interesting YA literature that has been and continues to be published.
That really maybe approaches subjects that maybe some adults don't want to believe or understand that are happening to young people, even when it's their own children.
Absolutely. I'm one of the things I've noticed, there's a big and unfortunate tendency for books to get challenged and for parents to be very concerned about a certain book being in a school, and then they'll try and get it, you know, rather than talking to their own child and say, hey, I don't want you to read this, which I've done with my own kids. I have a 12-year-old, and I'll say, I don't think you're ready for that book, which is, of course, a sure way for her to want to read it. But rather than saying, I don't want you to do that, they'll try and get it removed from the school. And it creates this real intense fight between, you know, authors and librarians and parents. And I look at some of the books that are challenged, and as a parent, I feel like I have some empathy toward it, because it's parents, I think, this sort of magical thinking that if my child doesn't read about rape, if my child doesn't read about, you know, drug abuse or self-harm, then it won't happen. And A, that's not true, and B, reading about it doesn't make it happen at all. In fact, I think for a lot of young people, that sense of like, oh, I'm not alone here, I can actually talk about that. Like Laurie Halse Anderson's breakthrough YA novel Speak was, you know, one of the first books about acquaintance rape. And I think it really, it continues to be challenged and banned. But it gave young people a way to recognize something that had happened to them and to understand that it was actually a crime, because there's so much shame and silence around it. So the books can be very powerful, but I think that, you know, misguided fear a lot from parents has led them, some of these books, to be challenged.
You mentioned If I Stay, and that's the book that was made into a motion picture?
Yeah. Right, that's why it's yes. You talk about You Can't Get There From Here. People always think If I Stay is my first book, and I have to say, no, that's just the first one anybody paid attention to. So that was my third book and my second novel, and that was sort of the one that even before it came out, it was, you know, being published in, you know, many, many countries, and then it was made into a movie with Chloe Grace Moretz, and that came out in 2014.
So some of our listeners and readers may have seen the film, and hopefully now you will be drawn to the book. And so you have a whole body of YA books. And before we move on to Leave Me, which is your current publication, some of your books have recurrent characters, are like a series. And I wonder what is the joy and challenge for you as a writer carrying characters through a couple different books?
If I Stay and Where She Went and Just One Day and Just One Year, they're both sequels, but very different kinds of sequels, because with If I Stay, I didn't intend to write a sequel, but after I finished it and was writing this whole other book that I completed, I kept waking up in the middle of the night. The characters were like, you know, where have you left us? And I didn't want to think about it. And when I did, I kind of jumped ahead a few years and told Adam's story. And that was sort of one kind of experience. And it was delightful because I already knew this character so well. So it was just putting on his skin was very, very easy. With Just One Day and Just One Year, I conceived of them differently, where I wanted the books to read like transparencies, where you read the first book and you see a certain picture, and then you lay the other one on top, and the picture changes because it's one is from Allison's point of view and one is from Willem, and they spend this one day together in Paris. And then it really chronicles each of their year after that, what happened after that day. And I think I like the switch of perspective, and I think this goes back to traveling, because one of the things you learn from traveling is how much perspective matters and how much the lens that you look at through things completely changes the picture. So I like playing with that narratively, where you think this is the story, and then somebody else comes and you form an opinion of somebody and a character based on what you've read, and then you read something else and it's like, oh. So I think that's kind of a recurring lesson for me, because I sometimes have to say, wait, you know, somebody else is seeing it differently and I'm misreading a situation, which I think we do constantly. So that is fun. So I've written those duet of duets, as I like to say.
I think it's a gratifying experience, too, for a reader to, first of all, you don't necessarily have to even approach the series from this way or this way. You could maybe pick up one book and then pick up another one. But seeing that different perspective, I don't know. I think it's an exciting experience for a reader as well, and opens things up in different ways.
I enjoy it, and I definitely enjoyed writing. And I sometimes read series out of order. I read the Margaret Atwood, Mad Adam trilogy out of order, and I think it made the reading experience even better, because I jumped into the second one. I had no idea what was going on. It's this crazy futuristic dystopian world, and it was even more intensive. It was intensified by the fact that I didn't know what had caused it. So then I went back and read the first one, and I think I loved them, and I would love them in any order, but I think the fact that I read them out of order made me love the experience more.
So you have this body of young adult fiction, and now we have Leave Me, and it is an adult book, or it's being marketed that way.
I call it a book starring adults, because
okay.
in a nod to the many adults who read YA, and also remembering that 18-year-old me read Anne Tyler. So,
and something that does run through all your books is this examination of loss, insecurity, how that affects our relationships with people we love and, mm-hmm. and with our own ability to be in the world. And Leave Me is no different. And this isn't a spoiler alert, because it might even be on the first page of the book.
It's the first sentence. Yeah.
That it opens with a heart attack. Yep. And that had me clutching my chest through the first several pages of the book. And I thought that was a bold way to open the book and literally clutch the reader.
If it makes you feel any better, I had horrible chest pains throughout writing this and revising it. But yes, I mean, because the point of the story is not the heart attack or even the bypass surgery. It's what happens after. And I think that I am aware that major life events like this, they tend to kind of shake your foundations in many ways and make you, again, the perspective changes. Like all of a sudden you see things differently. And in Mary Beth's case, she has the heart attack and she has the bypass surgery. And then she comes home. She has twin 4-year-olds and a husband. And they all lean heavily on her because she's the default parent and she has always kept all the balls in the air. And even after the surgery, they don't know how not to lean on her. And she doesn't know how to get better, how to take care of herself so she can be there for her kids while at the same time being overwhelmed to the point that it's causing her health to deteriorate. So she runs away. And I think that was really the story there. You know, it really is about what happens when she leaves and why she's left, because there's, you know, it's sort of like a Trojan horse where she and her husband Jason have the fight that every married couple with children I know has about laundry or about carpooling and about who does more and who has less time and who's more stressed. And I know many mothers, myself included, who do not know how to ask for help or feel guilty asking for help. And so she has all that going on, and that seems to be the reason that she's leaving. But once she's left, she has this time to kind of really look at what's going on under the surface and what really caused her to run.
And thank you for setting up the story that way for our listeners, because there is a lot of depth and there's a lot of shocking elements in the book, and you just mentioned a primary one, that she has a family and she has a job. And after she has this heart surgery, she leaves home. And that in itself is something that makes a character somewhat unsympathetic, but yet there is something very sympathetic about her. And so as an author, that's a pretty delicate line to have your character do something, abandon her children seemingly, yeah, and then to slowly unpeel that situation and metering out information as we go through the book.
You know, it's shockingly taboo what she does, in a way that when readers are so angry at me for having written a book like this, I say, well, flip it. And if it was the father that ran away and in the same situation, how would you feel? And fathers don't have that same kind of obligation to kind of put everything aside for the family. So she runs away. It's incredibly taboo. And yet the most fascinating thing about writing this book and talking about this book, just today I came from an event where a woman happened in. She wasn't even coming to the event, but she happened into hear us talking about it. And when I said it's about a mother who runs away, afterwards she came up and she said to me, she said, I fantasize about that and I can't tell anybody. I'm scared to tell anybody. And when I was writing the book, that was the universal reaction among mothers, where they would whisper to me, like, sometimes I dream about staying on the freeway past my exit and just driving off into the sunset. And they all felt this way. And yet there was all this shame about it because it is so taboo. So yes, Mary Beth does this shocking, unforgivable thing. And I think about Kramer versus Kramer a lot. And I remember watching that as a child. And Meryl Streep is just the villain. You know, you are so in it with the father and the children who have just been abruptly left by this selfish woman. But what would happen if we followed her? And that's what happens with Mary Beth, is you are along for the ride with her. And so even if you don't agree with what she does, my hope is that you understand. And I think for a lot of working mothers who have that second and third shift where they spend a day at work and then they come home and they are responsible for getting dinner on the table and helping with math homework and understanding the emotional state of the children, there's just never a moment to check out. And so I think that's where that desire to run away comes from. So perhaps most of us would not pack a bag and go away for a couple months, but the desire is definitely there.
And she And we don't want to give too many of the details away, because that's the joy for our readers to
discover
themselves. But you've just expressed that it's something that maybe some people fantasize about or are definitely dealing with the frustrations of having to work through your personal questions, insecurities, feelings of abandonment, feelings of being used, whatever those feelings are, because we all do have them. Mm-hmm. And no matter how successful or tragic our lives are, that is a commonality. And she doesn't know that. And her relationship with her friend Elizabeth, I found interesting too, even though it wasn't central to the story, it, I think, does reveal something about long-term friendships between women.
I would say it is central to the story, even if Elizabeth is not on the page that much, because nobody's on the page who she hasn't, you know, because she's left them all. But with Elizabeth, it's this friend that she's had since she was, you know, since she moved to New York. And for a long time, even after she got together with Jason, her husband, Elizabeth was her person, you know. And I think we have this idea that these friendships, these deeply platonic friendships that I know other women have, that's something that once you have a family of your own and you create your own life and you have a partner and you have children, that those don't matter. It's time to put away childish things. Except I think that's ridiculous. And I think that puts such a pressure on a marriage if your partner is the one person that's supposed to be everything for your emotional support. So I know in my life I have these really, really close friends, and friend does not seem like the right word for it, because, you know, I also have Facebook friends who I've never met. How can these be the same thing? But these are people who are like family to me and who help me retain balance and equilibrium in my life that translates into my marriage. But I know when I was younger and I had friendships like this, about once a decade they fell apart and I get dumped, and I used to just be heartbroken over it, and I didn't understand why I was so heartbroken over it until in the 30s it was one of my best friends who treated it like a breakup. And then I realized, wait a second, friendship minimizes what these relationships are. They're deeply entwined. So that fed into Mary Beth and Elizabeth's relationship, because that relationship seems to be withering. Elizabeth has pulled ahead with Mary Beth professionally, and she's now Mary Beth's boss and almost a benefactor in a way. And it's a very uncomfortable situation. And Mary Beth misses that. And it's one more loss in her life that she hasn't really allowed herself to process until she leaves.
But then she also encounters some new people in her new situation, where she has a different identity, but her own identity prevails in a way.
I like playing with this idea of how we have many identities. So in Just One Day and Just One Year, like in Just One Day in particular, this character Allison, she's in Paris for a day and she goes with this guy and he renames her Lulu. And it allows the side of herself that she didn't know that was in there to come out for the day. And then the next day she's back to being Allison. It's like, how can I get that Lulu back? It's the same with Mary Beth. She leaves Pittsburgh and she wants to go off the grid. So she assumes a name. She calls herself MB, short for Mary Beth and Goldman, which is her maiden name. And then she starts to kind of establish these relationships with her neighbors, these young college students, her cardiologist, and a woman who is helping her search for her adoptive mother. I mean, for her biological mother. And I think relieved of all the expectations that she's placed on herself back home, she can have entirely different relationships with them. She can ask for help. She can be kind of messy. She can be a little snarky. And because she's not bringing all the baggage of this expectation, and it's all temporary, she develops these kind of really almost sort of healthier relationships than the model that she had back home.
And as the story transpires, she reestablishes communication with her husband. And that was done in the book through emails. And I found that interesting because it seemed like the distance and the separation allowed them to be more honest with each other than maybe when the kids and the parties and the schedules were in between.
Absolutely. I think there's something about, you know, writing. It allows you to get closer to the truth. It's a little bit easier. And they also are removed from their life. And also they've had this major earthquake, which I think is something in a lot of couples that have been together long term, that you can kind of find yourself arthritic with all of the habits and the things left unsaid. And then something major happens and it can sometimes be horrible, but it allows you to just sort of say, let's just clear this away and speak to each other more honestly. And so they wind up having the sort of the email exchange, very tentative and kind of angry at first. But I enjoyed writing that kind of aspect of it, where it was happening bit by bit. And I thought about how when my husband and I first met, we were together for about a month or two and then went away. And our relationship was an epistolary relationship for the next 6 months. And sometimes I wonder if that is why we wound up together, because we were able to get to know each other and not get freaked out or reveal ourselves in this way. There's something just about, you know, writing it down that allows a distance that allows an intimacy, ironically.
And in this story, Mary Beth continues to discover things about herself and about her relationships that surprise her and comfort her, and she learns from, and that's maybe what you're about as a writer, of exploring those kind of situations with characters. Gail Forman, thanks so much for visiting us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
That was my conversation with Gail Forman. The book is Leave Me. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear my conversation with Silas Dent Zobel on his latest novel, The People of the Broken Neck. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. Of The People of the Broken Neck, John Vernon says, a thriller and a deeply philosophical novel, so finely attuned to the dark currents of human love and aggression that it touches those wellsprings that lie beneath the human. The novel opens with ex-Army Ranger Dominic Sawyer hiding in the woods with his nearly grown son Clark and his young daughter King, while watching Agent Charlie Basin's flashlight beam bounce on the walls inside of their cabin. Dominic's wife is missing. His post-trauma hallucinations rip at him explosively, and the family begins a cross-country saga of flight. The author, Silas Dent Zobel, has been awarded an NEA fellowship and teaches for the Writers Institute at Susquehanna University in Pennsylvania. He is currently spending a year in France, and I spoke with him from there. I should say he was there. Sadly, I was not. Let's listen to our conversation. Silas Dent Zobel, welcome remotely to talking to us here in Sonoma County. The People of the Broken Neck is your latest book, and it seems to be a story about fathers, about the devastating effects of war, and written in a way that we weave through the thoughts and consciousness of many people. And at the heart of the story is a father with post-traumatic stress. So can you tell us a little bit about what drove you into the direction of writing this kind of story?
A lot of things drove me there, things coming together at once. And I think the one that leaps to mind first is that I'm a father and have two children, and I feel constantly protective of them and also constantly aware of how I'm not a great father, meaning I do think I'm a good dad in general terms, but that as parents we are stifling our children in some way, that every boundary we set on them for their own good is potentially problematic.
In the book, there is nobody who is untouched by their parents. But this father, Dominic, we as the readers have a sympathy for him because his love and compassion is manifested, but there's something more uncontrollable about him that really drives the story. And at several points in the book, there are statements made by another character, Charlie Basin, who is also a father and is also dealing with the relationships with his children, but that make comments about the nature of killing, the nature of tracking, and so, I don't know, the story isn't about war, but yet maybe for the past several hundred years we've been living with fathers who are walking around wounded and carrying that burden on to their children.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, partly what I was wondering in the book is the effect of relatively constant violence of war, but also violence at home. As I was writing it, soldiers were coming back home and committing acts of violence all around because of the violence that they'd suffered. And I was wondering over and over again what the ramifications were to all of us, but maybe particularly to masculinity, that the way that violence is identified in some ways with masculinity and what trauma that inflicted on all of us as children, in a way. So what it meant to both Dominic's children to have him as a father, both his boy and his girl, and what that meant to them. And for me, I mean, the other parts, aside from being a father, the other things that were very interesting to me or that motivated me to write it was I grew up somewhat violently, and there was a lot of violence in my family. From long ago, my great-great-grandfather, my grandfather, to some degree my parents, my brother and I, and certainly not the kind of violence one finds in war, but violence nonetheless. And where did that come from? Where did we get that? And how do we get rid of it, I thought, particularly?
Well, the son, Dominic's son, Clark, who is named for his father, and there's a connection there, he is constantly examining, even unconsciously, his own actions out of a sense of loyalty to his dad, out of the modeling his dad is doing. But he also has this drive to and conflict about wanting to maybe break free of that, but not being able to because the bonds of family are so strong.
Yeah, I guess I'm constantly wondering in the book and in my own life to what degree we are constrained by who our parents were and to what degree we're constrained by ideas of masculinity and of femininity and how much I have a son and a daughter like Dominic does and how much my children are constrained, who they will be by who I am and by ideas of what a girl or boy should be. And I would like them not to be too constrained, but I also really don't much know what to do about it.
I found the book, and you've mentioned masculinity a couple times, and I did find the book, I would call it a masculine book, that really was, there were women in the book, and Dominic's daughter, he has a daughter, King, her reaction to all this is central to our focus as a reader. Right. And but it did feel like a struggle of men, an examination of men, and especially to me the juxtaposition of Dominic to the FBI agent who was pursuing him and his relationship with his family, that he was struggling as well. And I found that juxtaposition kind of an interesting one in the story, almost mirror images in a way, the pursuer and the pursued, or their Dominic at times was functioning in both roles as the pursuer and the pursued. So I don't know, structuring the story must have been a challenge for you, or maybe it is the joy of your own writing, because the book has an almost stream of consciousness feel to it, of not a strong demarcation between chapters or characters, that we can be in the action of one kind of exterior element of the narrative weaving into somebody's interior thinking. And the book flows kind of like a river almost, with a lot of different currents. Can you talk about writing the book?
Sure. It was a long struggle to write the book, and structurally it came slowly. I started mostly interested in the two children. And Dominic came along behind them because the children needed parents. And then I got very, very interested in Dominic and him being a veteran. And I knew I had recently met, as I was writing the book, someone who had just come home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And certainly he was not struggling in the same way that Dominic is struggling. But he was struggling, and he was undergoing a kind of profound change in the way he understood patriotism and the way he understood his relationship to kind of inherited ideas of what it is to be masculine. And so the stuff with the FBI agent, Charlie Basin, came in much later. He was a very backgrounded character. And as I wrote and finished and then revised, I went through many revisions, I became more and more interested in him, especially so that I could elicit the ways that parents have failed, no matter how wonderful of parents they are, and that both of those men are driven to some degree by notions of what it is, stereotypical notions of what it is to be masculine, and they are, you know, somewhat unwittingly imposing that on the people around them. So I do think the book is about masculinity to a degree. However, I think for me that King, the daughter, is always been the heart of the book, and that in the end she is, if there is a solution to the book, she's it. That in some ways every man in the book is somewhat trapped, and she's the only one who can see a way out of the trap.
She does have a wisdom and a sight that comes through. And in some ways, you know, I think when I was reading, I thought of Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird as somebody who witnesses and watches and puts pieces together for us.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but now that you mentioned it, I can see that too.
As they moved through the country and came in and out of people's lives, there was at once a humanity, but also a depravity that almost each individual had to face and is revealed. And usually it's not very straightforward, that here is a man, Dominic, who is, even as the readers, we maybe don't want to believe what he has done, because we have a great deal of sympathy for him as a reader, and so do some of the characters. And could you talk a little bit about that It's not straightforward who is good and who is bad.
Yeah, I certainly hope it's not straightforward. And so I'm glad you didn't find it that way. Dominic is, by the end, a man who, if you judge him by his actions, has gone terribly off track, has done things terribly wrong. But if I've done my job, I've shown his heart the whole time. And he is what I think we all are as fathers and mothers, which is deeply in love with their children, and in love with many other things, and deeply in love with the country. And if we as readers, and I as a writer, can feel that in him, then he's like us, even if he behaves in ways that are ways that we reject. And so that was critical to me, because certainly he behaves in ways that I will never behave. However, that heart of him, the part that loves his family, that is utterly devoted to them, that is trying to protect them, even though he doesn't quite know that what they need protection from is him. That part, I think, is all of us, or I hope it is.
Yes. And then his counterpart in Charlie Basin, his engagement with his children is different, a little bit of a sense of remove. I think Charlie doesn't know what he needs to do with his children, whereas Dominic does.
I think that's right. I mean, that I hope that there's almost a sense that Charlie has learned something from Dominic by the end, that watching this man who's making mistake after mistake stay close to his children and try to protect them and love them desperately is the right thing despite his constant failures. And so Charlie, who in many ways is doing the right thing, he's hunting down men and women who need to be hunted down, but he's spending all his time away from his children. He's distant from them. And I think that, you know, by the end, he has a sense of the way he has erred.
It is a growth or a transition that he goes through, but it's not necessarily a happy one. It's at a cost. And at one point, Charlie says, I think I'm probably paraphrasing here, but he says something like, "Did a secret ever hide anything that mattered? Were important things always hidden in plain sight?" And that statement encapsulated some of the secrets and truths that these two men were experiencing.
Yeah, I like that.
I found bringing all of these characters into the story at once was really accelerating, with an ominous feeling of what might happen. And at each place that Dominic took his children, there was a sense of impending dread. Yet I felt like I was rooting for them all to stay together and stay whole, even though there's dysfunction at the heart of it.
Yeah, I that's a product of I think two things in my life, and one is that my childhood was one in which everything was always falling apart, and I think everybody, my dad and mom, my brother and I, all loved each other desperately in our ways, and so we were trying to hold things together, but they couldn't be held. And then the other, you know, maybe it's those earlier experiences that leads me to feel that about my current life, which is very stable, solid, stable, and happy. You know, my family has moved to France for a year. We are, by any measure at the moment, let's cross our fingers and hope it stays this way, doing well. But I can never shake the feeling that things will come undone. None of this just lasts. The beautiful time when your children are, as mine are, at the moment, 7 and 10, doesn't last. Anyone who's had children knows they grow so unbearably quickly. And no matter what period of time we get through without there being some calamity, any one of us who is paying attention knows it's coming. And I don't know what it is, but it's you know, there's another one coming. And so I hope there's a sense in the novel, even as they're running under this tremendous pressure, that they're stopping in places of the country and just noticing how wonderful our country is. You know, stopping as they travel and just being in awe of the beauty of each state.
They do take a road trip, and the story opens up along the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania, and I felt like nature was a big part of the story as well, and something that Dominic brought to his children was that attention to nature.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, a flawed but lovely man, and you know, he's teaching them a way of paying attention to the world, and part of that is terrific. It's something that will bear them well, and part of it is violent and horrible.
And I think that just what you're saying about something's coming, because that really is the nature of living, isn't it? That
unfortunately.
Yes, you could be the best parent, but you don't know the effects of your words or actions on your children. And that's the great unknown of being a parent, that what these children become is largely up to them. And maybe that is the hope of King, the daughter in your story, that she pays attention and sees what's around her.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, and that, I mean, this is terrible to say it's a success of hers, but that, you know, she's the one who's able to a degree reject her father. And then she calls him back, and he comes. But he doesn't come quite as what he was before.
Tell me about the title, The People of the Broken Neck.
Well, I'll tell you the practical part first, which is that it's a line from Toni Morrison's Beloved, which is a book that I love and have read many times. And so there's that. It's also related to a literal broken neck in the novel, and so there's that in a way that the family are the people of the broken neck, that they are the ones dealing with the consequence of a neck having been broken. So those are the practical parts, and then I guess, as I was writing this book, and certainly this continues right now, given the kind of constant violence of our country, that I felt like we were the people of the broken neck, that we are the people dealing with the after effects of violence that is our own and violence that belongs to someone else too.
Yes, it seems that is really an unfortunate thing we're all dealing with. There was something also, there were a lot of guns in the book, and at one point somebody says, maybe it was Dominic saying, the purpose of a handgun is to kill people.
Yeah.
And at that moment, that's not what they were doing. But that sort of statement also was kind of chilling, that he was saying that to his children as he was preparing guns.
Yeah, well, handguns are chilling. The purpose of a handgun is to kill people. It's unfortunately straightforward.
Yes, that's all it is.
Yeah, that's what it is. Right? You know, I mean, if we're going to have handguns around, we should make it pretty clear that the purpose is to kill people and that we need to deal with that purpose as we have handguns around.
Yes.
And it is chilling. I agree. But, you know, that's the purpose of a handgun.
Also, something about, and getting back to that whole thing of masculinity, of parenting, of being a father, of being a parent, but also the notion of being able to examine oneself. And that, I think, was the difference between Dominic and Charlie Basin, the FBI, the hunted and the hunter, that Charlie was a little bit more able to look at himself and what he was doing. And Dominic could not easily, I should say.
Yeah, I think that's right, that that Dominic is just not a reflective man. And you know, and Charlie, I wouldn't say that he's especially reflective. But at his age, which is more advanced, and he is in at that moment a more reflective time in his life. And I think it has something to do with his relationship with Dominic.
Yes.
This sense that he's hunting this man who he had his life gone poorly. He could have been.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, The People of the Broken Neck is your book. I'm talking with Silas Dent Zobel from Paris. Where are you in France?
I am in Aix-en-Provence, which is south of Paris by a good bit, about 30 minutes from the Mediterranean Sea.
And so I guess I want to ask you about that and about traveling to a country that has experienced its own set of recent violence over the last couple of years and terrorism. And had you had thoughts about bringing your family there?
Not in terms of its violence. I don't, you know, the violence here does not seem to be any worse than the violence at home. I know the violence at home a lot better. You know, I've been in France for a month. I am not an expert here, that's for sure. My French is rudimentary. I can see the fear here in the same way I see the fear at home. In Aix, there are armed guards around more than there used to be, I'm told. And so, you know, that's spooky, of course. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have any nervousness about traveling. I mean, I don't know. I'm of the mind that it's good for me and good for my kids. And I haven't had the opportunity many times in my life, certainly not as a kid. I was raised poorly. But now that I have it, I just feel like I will grab the chance when I get it.
And is your wife also a writer?
She is. Yes, absolutely. She is a writer, and she is writing. Good for her. She is writing daily, and that is the idea. I mean, I plan to write another book while I'm here, but I'm so far this first month not as fast at it as I'd like. I've been writing other things, essays and that kind of thing.
And maybe learning how to go shopping at the market.
There's that too. How to get my kids to school. You know, I've been a lot of kind of very basic learning going on here.
Well, Silas, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Suzanne.
That was my conversation with Silas Dent Zobel. I was talking with him from Provence, where he is on sabbatical from Susquehanna University. Silas's previous work includes The Inconvenience of Wings, and today we've spoken with him about his novel, The People of the Broken Neck. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard from Gail Forman on her book, Leave Me. Today we've had production assistance from Mark Prell and Mary Moore Campagna. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org and listen anytime through iTunes. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening today. It's a novel idea.